Okay, so we need to revisit the postulates of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is that quantum mechanics is a lot of mechanics, and that's often lost in the translation, right? But we know that from a fundamental basis, we don't really propose quantum theories. That's not a thing we do. At a fundamental level, we propose classical theories. At a fundamental level, we propose actions based on symmetries. That's what we do. And actions are, if you ever see a Lagrangian with hats, then don't trust the person who's writing that too much, because Lagrangians are classical things. Actions are classical things. Then, of course, at some point, seems that it's not enough with, at least for now, for classical mechanics to reproduce things that you see. And then physicists start doing things that are a bit weird. And then people like von Neumann and others arrive and say, well, okay, what you're doing is the following. You're getting the phase space of your system, and you are representing your dynamical functions by postulate two, by self-adjoint operators on a Hilbert space. Now, we're not going to discuss much, but I'm going to just mention under what conditions you can actually do that, because it so happens there's a theorem that tells you that you almost never can do it, but we do it anyways. I don't know if you've seen any of that. Some of you might, some of you might not, but there's a thing. Quantum mechanics is ill-defined. The map that quantizes a classical system is ill-defined in most cases, even in the simplest, even for a free particle. We need to deal with that. And that is a whole how we do it, and we represent dynamical functions of self-adjoint operators is non-trivial. Again, typical problem that I tell you for inspiration, consequence of these things is, imagine that I give you a classical Hamiltonian, dp squared divided by 2m, even that one. That's a free particle, non-relativistic, and I tell you what is the quantum version of that, what is the self-adjoint operator H representing this Hamiltonian, then you may say, oh yeah, maybe that, right? Perhaps. Well, and this one is actually okay, because that's, you know, maybe let me add a harmonic oscillator. M omega x squared, something like that. Can we put hats? Well, the answer is technically no. And this one can, but you could do this. You could add here a multiple of the identity, right? In fact, you can add things that vanish. For example, I can add something that goes with I, the commutator of x and p. Right? If I add that in the classical limit, when you take h bar going to zero, that will disappear. Agreed?
Yeah.
Well, I can also add this. If I want. No? And if you actually compute the dynamics that this Hamiltonian generates, this is of course, I identity H bar, no? So there's a valid Hamiltonian in quantum mechanics. And the classical limit of that coincides with the classical harmonic oscillator. So which one it is? Which one is the Hamiltonian representing the harmonic oscillator? The one that I added this or the one that I added that? Both reproduce the same classical Hamiltonian. See what I mean? Do you have any reason to pick that one over this one?
Occam's razor.
Yeah, but Occam's razor
fails, actually, because if I give you products of, imagine that I give you that the classical Hamiltonian is px, which one do you pick for the quantum version? You pick, well, you cannot pick px, because that's a self-adjoint. So you have to pick maybe the average, symmetrization, perhaps. Is that the one you pick?
No.
That's Occam's razor, too. You could have picked a different one. You could have picked x 1/2 p x 1/2. That was self-adjoint. Completely different dynamics from this. So which one is the one that corresponds to the classical Hamiltonian there? Well, in general, you have polynomials of, you can quantize the Hasselberg algebra, that's fine. Q, p, and identity, I can also, q, p, x, p, and 1, I can quantize. Polynomials of that, I don't know how. It's ill-defined. So we need to make a choice. And the choice that we make is typically is called the Weyl quantization. And Weyl quantization is, I pick a Weyl said, okay, I don't know how to do the quantization of polynomials or any function, any dynamical function, so I'm going to pick the symmetric one. So that the exponential of lambda x plus mu p, quantizer is just putting hats on it. That's his choice. It's not the only choice. You can do different quantizations. But anyway, this is not part of the quantum information course. It's a little bit of foundations of quantum mechanics that is not typically discussed. But at least, hopefully, I transmitted that there's a problem with quantizing classical systems, no? It's not well defined how to put hats to classical functions. And keep in mind that when we give a theory, we never start from scratch from quantum. Fundamentally, we always give an action, and an action is classical. Make sense, everybody?
I'm confused about the exponent thing. So you were saying you did that. You're saying why did you say you took?
Because of decree, because of the will of Bayle, because of a human being that decided let's use this.
So it was an arbitrary choice.
It is an arbitrary choice.
Okay, but then that means you can quantize like polynomials because you just expand that.
That's right, and the quantization of polynomials is non-trivial, huh? Well, in this case, it's the full symmetrization of the polynomial. Get all the possibilities and weigh them with the same weight. That is what you do with that one. But you could have done another. You could have quantized this. So see, if you have this in the exponential, you could have quantized this as this, for example, which is completely different. And that's also another quantization. That's a global quantization. So the different quantizations are also associated with different representations in phase space for quantum states. But again, this is not part of the course that we've seen. It's good to know if you ever do continuous variable quantum information. Because in continuous variable quantum information, these considerations are good. If you're limited to finite dimensions, it doesn't matter much. But it's good to keep it, right? Quantum mechanics is not as clean as one can think. Quantizing a quantum system is actually, again, there's a theorem called Gremsvold theorem that tells you under what conditions you can find a self-adjoint representation for observables, map the Poisson bracket to the I h-bar commutator, and that the representation is irreducible, which you need. Because if the representation is not irreducible, you contradict postulate one that I put in here. So you need to have irreducible representations. So that can only happen for a very small subset of phase spaces. And that doesn't even cover a single particle, a free particle. So you cannot quantize almost anything. But you have the trick that you can quantize what is called the Heisenberg algebra. Heisenberg algebra being 1, x, and p. And because you can do that, it's like, okay, fine. I can find a representation for 1, x, and p. What about polynomials and functions of those? And the answer is, well, that's ill-defined, but you maybe can pick one way of doing it and go ahead and see if that works for you. That makes sense? But there's a lot more depth. I teach this at the University of Waterloo, so called Quantum Theory 3. Anyway, it's typically not mentioned much. Some of you may have heard it. Have you heard it before? Yeah. If you've ever seen symplectic formulations of quantum mechanics, that's the beginning of it. Okay. All right, anyway, back to quantum information mode. We have here two of the three postulates. The reason I don't have postulate one is because postulate one speaks about states. And I want to leave it at the end because it's going to be the focus of the lecture here. Postulate two tells us that physical observables, which I say in principle measurable properties of the system, are represented by possibly unbounded self-adjoint operators on a Hilbert space H. For us, it's going to be bounded always because we're going to work in these finite dimensions that we're going to work with in this course. But just to have the complete postulate, on a Hilbert space H, then the result of a measurement of an observable that produces a definite value. Okay, so you postulate that, well, there exist measurements that when I do it on my system gives me a number, a map from a quantum system to a number that I call measurement, right? We'll talk about measurements in its own lecture, so don't worry too much about that. It's always going to be in the spectrum of the operator that represents it. That's the postulate. Make sense? Postulate three is about the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics, Born's rule. The probability of measuring an outcome AI when measuring the observable represented by self-adjoint operator A on a state rho is given by this. So this is the probability. We call it P. A equals AI. But of course, This is the eigenprojector on the associated with the eigenvalue A. Again, I wrote it here. It's a little bit more subtle if you have infinite dimensions, but it's okay, and we can live with this. Now, these two postulates here, we're going to use 3.5 postulates, so effectively four postulates. Postulate one is going to be about the rows, how we characterize states. Postulate four, or 3.5, or whatever you want to call it, is going to be about measurements. Okay? But we don't need more postulates. How many postulates have you taught typically when you see quantum mechanics? Typically five. What are the others? Your mileage may vary. Different people have different postulates. What are the others? Just to make sure that we are compatible with all that. I'm going to say four. I mean, I call it 3.5. But I'm gonna say four, not five. Which one's the fifth? Which ones am I missing? Huh? Hilbert space representation is going to be in postulate one. So, what's that? Yeah, well, Schrödinger equation. That's typically postulated. Notice that you don't need to postulate that one. You can do an alternative postulate, which is the laws of physics are independent of the inertial reference frame. And your space-time transformations are the Galilei transformations. And then you get Schrödinger equation, the usual one. So you don't need to postulate it. Schrödinger equation can be derived instead of postulate. If you postulate it, it's fine. And then you say, well, Schrödinger equation is invariant under Galilei transformations. And if you have a potential, it's invariant under these reduced groups, you know, things like that. No, not necessarily. You can derive Schrödinger equation out of the symmetries of the Galilei group. If you impose other group of symmetries for space-time, like Poincaré, for example, then you get Poincaré doesn't have equivalent, one family of equivalent representations have several, so depending on the representation you pick for the Poincaré group, you're going to get Klein-Gordon, you're going to get Dirac equation, you're going to get Maxwell equation. Maxwell is so cool. He already had relativity incorporated in his theory and he didn't even know. Or you're going to get the linearized general relativity, if you want, wave, gravitational wave equations. You're going to get Tomonaga-Swinger, etc. All the equations of dynamics that are typically solved as relativistic quantum mechanics, those appear from the same thing. Those equations appear from demanding that the laws of physics are invariant and the changes of reference frame. Make sense? So again, you could postulate Schrödinger equation, which makes sense in a course that wants to be fast on that. When I teach quantum mechanics, typically I postulate invariance under the Galilei group, and we derive Schrödinger equation, which is kind of nice. So it's good to know. Yeah. I agree, but then again, that requires you to at least postulate an equation. What I mean is I don't like postulating an equation. Schrödinger equation as an act of faith never satisfied me. So Schrödinger equation can be derived. Yes, from another postulate. Of course, you need another postulate. And the postulate would be invariance under the Galilei group, something about space-time. Keep in mind that the talking about space-time tells you about time evolution. So, of course, very good. Just a couple comments. So I'm not going to have the postulate Schrödinger equation. It's implicitly that we have a Schrödinger equation because of the symmetries of space-time. So for these course effects, I am postulating Schrödinger equation, but I don't care much where it comes from. Make sense?
In postulate two, you're saying the result of a measurement of an observable that produces a definite value is of the spectrum of that operator. But the third postulate, you're using that, and you're saying the probability is equal to trace. So couldn't these two also be combined?
Typically, they're not. They could. You can just write the whole thing, sure. But this is about, so this is only talking about what happens when you measure once. But this is telling you about what's the probability of obtaining a value when you measure once. I could have an alternative postulate three that is different, would not reproduce nature, maybe, but I can tell you the probability could be a different thing. And still postulate two is fine.
So you're saying that
these are not related. They're independent postulates. Is that what you mean?
I think they're kind of related because you're using the spectrum of A to define the probability.
Yeah.
Postulate three. So it's
the spectrum of A exists independently of. So I agree that you need postulate two before postulate three. That's where they're ordered.
Oh, okay.
But they're independent in sense of what they impose. Okay. Postulate three. I can have postulates two and postulate three prime is something else, and I have a different theory. Postulate 2 does not imply postulate 3. That's what I mean. Although, sure, I'm using postulate 2. I already have it. That's why it's this. Sorry. In fact, I'm using rho here, I haven't told you what it is, so that's postulate one, right? Okay, so let's see postulate one. So people who are online can ask questions too, no? I assume, yeah.
Jackie.
All right.
Jackie. Hello.
Ah, nice, hello. Wow, I was like, what's that? Oh, one quick comment. I say here, in principle, measurable observable. What is a physical observable is something that also requires discussion. I'm not gonna get into that, but this goes only one way, not the other. Something that is represented by a self-adjoint operator is not necessarily a physical observable. Typical example is a gauge field, okay, like A, for example, in electromagnetism. That's not a physical observable, and yet you represent it as a self-adjoint operator. Because it's a dynamical function. That's what you do when you quantize. But it goes like that, the postulate, okay? Not the opposite. Not every self-adjoint operator is physical. Make sense? All right. Postulate one. To each physical state, there corresponds a unique state operator.
Yes, it is.
Which we call the density operator. And oftentimes we abuse and say density matrix. Which has to satisfy rho is an operator on the Hilbert space, H. I should have said because it's postulate one technically, which has to satisfy that number one. Positive semi-definite. Technically, demanding that this is positive semi-definite requires you to have psi and phi, where psi and phi are both in the Hilbert space. But this is a complex Hilbert space.
So define ket psi.
Vectors of the Hilbert space. It's math, not physics.
Uh-oh.
All right, makes sense. I use kets for vectors in the Hilbert space. I use bras for linear functionals on the Hilbert space. Makes sense. Anyway, it's a complex vector space. So demanding that that this is true means that it's positive semi-definite. Rho is positive semi-definite. Or in other words, all R positive semi-definite. By that I mean non-negative. Two. The trace of rho is 1. Okay, of course, the trace is just to introduce more notation. Equals 1, where this thing is an orthonormal basis of H. Okay. Of course, yeah.
So you have to choose a basis to.
No. The trace is basis independent.
Right.
Yeah.
This is just some orthonormal basis.
Yeah, that's some orthonormal basis.
Okay.
When I say in fact, you can even write it in terms of any basis, right? The trace, it's not going to look like this if it's not orthonormal, but any basis you can write the trace as, even if it's over complete, no problem. So I want to make sure that this is basis independent, that statement, obviously. Make sense? All right, 3. This is just for notation purposes. Maybe I should put it like that. Okay. And 3, of course, it is self-adjoint. Perhaps I should have ordered them differently. Perhaps I should have said self-adjoint first, then posit semi-definite. There's these reasons, right? Because whatever. All right, so why these properties? This postulate. So I'm saying that every state that is physical, I can represent with a density operator satisfying these properties. Why? Yeah.
So we can preserve Born's rule? Like as we evolve a state, it preserves probability?
Yeah, that's true, but that's not the only way to preserve Born's rule. I could have said that the states are just projectors, and that preserves Born's rule as written. This is more general than that. It's because we want rho to be something in particular. And then for that, we need to discuss a little bit the difference between what I will call in this course, not a notion, so don't quote me on this is a notion, but this is important, that I will discuss on this course, something that is like uncertainty or quantum uncertainty versus classical uncertainty, ignorance. Okay, so typically it's said that quantum mechanics, one of the differences between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics is that quantum mechanics is intrinsically probabilistic. What is meant by that? Because I can make a classical theory probabilistic, no problem. The statistical mechanics is about that, right? The fact that I don't have access to the degrees of freedom, the microscopic degrees of freedom, I only have access to some macroscopic degrees of freedom, means that my theory is going to have to be probabilistic. Quantum mechanics has a difference in the sense that I can know exactly the microstate of my system and yet may not be able to predict the outcome of a given experiment, which classically, typically doesn't happen. Make sense? So we have to consider you have something like this, right? If you had a state.
Sorry, why did you say typically?
Because the question whether a theory that has this kind of uncertainty over outcomes is or not possible to write as a classical theory is non-trivial. So the answer is no, you can. There's something really different from classical mechanics when you do quantum mechanics. But finding what that difference is a full, is half a course.
Yeah, no, but you said classically, you don't say something intrinsically is probabilistic because if you know the microscopic state of the system, you can predict everything. But
that's correct.
Typically, were you talking about chaos or is it something else?
I'm talking about many caveats. One is chaos, but there are others too, right? In the sense that, okay, what do you mean by knowing the microscopics, you know the macroscopics? It means that you have an integrable system. So if it's not, you're talking about chaos. If it's not integrable, do you really know what's going on? But anyway, whatever. So it's a very important difference, right? And also the problem of, can I think of quantum mechanics as a weird classical theory is non-trivial. Of course, the answer we know very well, that no, you can't. It's definitely different from a classical theory, no matter how bizarre. But that's a question that I will not address here. So I just want to be careful with those statements. Okay. But in this case, you have uncertainty about the outcome of some measurements on the system. However, you know exactly the state of the system. You know the microscopics of it, if you want. It's that state. But in quantum mechanics, you could also have classical ignorance in the sense that, well, maybe I don't know exactly what state I have, but I know something about the system. I know that maybe 25% of the time is this, 55% of the time is something else, and the other 25% of the time is something else. That's still ignorance, but it's classical ignorance. You see? You can have classical ignorance about the quantum state. Make sense? That notion of entropy that we're talking about, in a way. That makes sense? All right. So I want to think of rho is a classical probability distribution over pure states. And what do we call pure states? We call pure states that I know exactly what they are, that I have no ignorance about. Make sense? Microscopic, the equivalent to microscopic configurations in your statistical mechanics. Does that make sense? So I want rho to be that.
I'm not sure about the pure states, the kind of microstate in statistical mechanics, because sometimes they're not distinguishable.
It doesn't matter that they're not distinguishable.
Right?
I don't say equivalent, I say analog.
Okay.
So it's not exactly the same. But it's you see, you can think of the density function on phase space in classical mechanics. What is the density function? It's a probability distribution over definite classical states. This is the same. This is a probability distribution over definite quantum states. So that's what I mean by analog. Right? Make sense? Where these PIs are, these are convex combinations. So these PIs are probabilities, right? So PIs are the sum of the PIs is 1, and the PIs are larger than 0 or equal. Make sense? So that means the first one in particular, that the trace of rho is equal to 1. So demanding that the trace is equal to 1 and the eigenvalues are positive is related with the fact that we want it to be a probability distribution over pure states. Make sense? So the density operator here, as you see it, is expressing a notion of classical ignorance about your quantum state. If all the p's are 0 but 1, then we know we have no ignorance whatsoever. The probability of finding the state phi I is 1. The probability that I have the state phi I is 1. Sorry, it's OK. Like, don't worry. No. What I mean is, like, don't worry at all. Just take your time. The probability of being in state phi I is pi. Make sense? And if it's 1, means that I know exactly that I'm in phi I. Now, for any given density operator, this is important that you'll practice in the next tutorial, which is when? Remind me? You don't know? Oh, okay.
It's not at regular times, like everything.
Yeah, it's different all the time.
I see. It may be today even, no?
No.
Okay, fair enough, not today. So in the next tutorial, you'll practice this. You know, you have seen this before, but there's only one way of writing rho as a combination of as a probability distribution over pure states like this. But there's infinitely many ways of writing rho as a probabilistic combination of things. For example, if you have a source that is telling you with probability 50% state 1, probability 50% state 2, and another that probability 25% 1 and 25% 2, and you combine them with some probability, you have a rho that is going to be a convex combination of other rows. And that kind of decomposition is not unique. So and interpreting rows as probability distributions, I mean, I'm not going to tell much about that. You should have seen this. But if not, you're going to practice it. So don't worry. But the thinking of rho as a combination, probabilistic combination of things, is only unique when those things are well defined, are unique, are probability one things, things that you know very well. Make sense? All right, the density operator indeed plays the role of the density function in statistical mechanics. The function that probability, the density function typically is over phase space. This one is over configuration space though, but plays the same role. If you Fourier transform this, you get the density function of phase space. Maybe I'm talking too much about these things, but rho, if you have a single particle, rho is a distribution over xx prime. So it's a distribution over configuration space twice. You can Fourier transform one of the arguments and get a distribution over phase space, or maybe a symmetric combination of them, and then you get the Wigner function, something called the Wigner function, which is a distribution over phase space. But hopefully, you see that this substitutes the density function in classical mechanics over configuration space. Make sense? All right. Now, of course, if it's a good distribution, let's do this just to have. You have done this 1,000 times, but you haven't done it with me. So if I wanted to compute the expectation value of some observable O, and of course, this is the trace of rho O as per postulate. Now, if I pick my favorite orthonormal basis to evaluate that trace, some J, OK, I call it that one J. I'm going to do the same as the neutral. I'll copy the wrong thing. Rho O EJ. So we substitute the density operator, and we get sum over I, sum over J, PI, EI, rho, I called it phi I, j, ej. Where's the observable? Sorry. Ej. And that, of course, because, I didn't say here. These things. I don't need to say it, because I didn't talk. The problem is I forgot to talk about why we demand this self-adjoint. These have to be corresponding to different PIs. These guys are orthonormal, are orthogonal. That's guaranteed. If you have eigenvectors associated with different eigenvalues of a self-adjoint operator, you know that the eigenvectors are orthogonal. Okay, so indeed, this phi I are distinguishable. Okay, I didn't say it, but that's important. Make sense? They span the identity. They are the spectral decomposition of the identity. They form an orthonormal basis. Okay, so we have. Because you can have degeneracy, and I didn't say so. Let's put it like that. Corresponding, they're orthogonal. Phi I, corresponding to different PIs are orthogonal. That's what I'm saying. Make sense? That's not new. That's already included in here. Make sense? I'm not going to use it, but let's remember it. Okay, so I can move this there and have ij pi. I'm going to move it like that. Phi I o ej. Ej phi I, and of course, because this is an orthonormal basis, this is the identity, and therefore what I'm left with is sum over I pi phi I o phi I. Make sense? So it satisfies what we want, the expectation value of some observable. Is a classical probability distribution of the expectation value of all the possible states that it could be with some probability. Make sense? Again, this is something you've seen a lot, I assume. But it's good to do it again. All right. Any questions so far? Front, out. So, pure and non-pure states. Okay, so imagine that if we know exactly what vector in H represents my state, I state rho, then rho, it's equal to a projector over the state. Obviously, probability 1 of being in that state, probability 0 of being in any other state. Make sense? Rho is rank 1. So, a rank 1 density operator is said to represent a pure state. If rho is pure, then we know that, of course, it's a projector. So rho square equals rho. And therefore, the trace of rho square is equal to the trace of rho is 1. Conversely, the trace of rho square is 1, then we know that rho square has to be equal to rho because of the properties of the density operator. So in this case, the trace of rho square being 1 is if and only if the state is a projector, a rank 1 density operator. Make sense? From the probabilistic interpretation of the state, we see that that means that I know exactly what state I'm in. It's not a probabilistic distribution over different state vectors. Make sense?
What do you mean exactly? I kind of have a feeling, but what do you mean by we know exactly what the vector is? Because you can write a pure state in a weird way, and then it can just, even though it is a pure state, but in a linear combination, a weird linear combination.
So linear combinations of states are known states. So this is important. This is what I want to explain. This is a known state. If you're in that state, you know what state you are. If you are in that state, you also know in what state you are. It's this superposition. Make sense?
You could call the whole thing a state.
Yeah.
But
and this is a very well-defined state. I know exactly what state I'm in. But you could be in a case that you are trying to produce that in the lab, but sometimes it fails. And sometimes you produce zero with 25% probability, for example. And 1 with 50% probability. And this with 25% probability. So that state is not going to be pure. You don't know exactly what state you have. You have a density operator. And again, you can also find different decompositions. So you can only find a unique decomposition when these are orthonormal for different probabilities, when they are distinguishable. But you'll see in the tutorial, this can be described as a different combination because these things are not orthogonal. So I agree. You have more than one way of understanding rho as a combination of things, as a distribution of things, but only one way, only one basis in which it's diagonal. It's self-adjoint, it's always diagonalizable. So there's a basis in which it's diagonal, and in that basis, you can think of it, oh, it's a distribution over pure states, always. You can always find a distribution over pure states that are distinguishable, always. Make sense? All right. So this is important. That's what I mean. If it's rank 1, then you know exactly there's only one state that it can be, that my state is, right? Not a probabilistic distribution over anything. Well, it is a delta probability distribution. It's 1 for that one and 0 for the rest. Make sense? This is very important because to understand in informational terms what we're doing here, these notions are extremely important. Make sense? That's why I like to review these things, even though, of course, you've seen probably to the nausea by now, but still. Again, you'll practice this in the tutorial. But you see that you can always write this like this. You can diagonalize rho. And then you are expressing rho as a probability distribution over states that are distinguishable. Make sense? All right, so again, because this is an if and only if, that rho is pure, the trace of rho square is 1. And if the trace of rho square is 1, rho is pure. That's what I mean, again, by the definition of pure is that it's representing a state that is known, in a way. Only one pure state associated with it, one state vector associated with it. Then we can have a measure of purity. We define purity. It's with a P, calligraphic P, of rho, to be the trace of rho square. Okay? So purity goes, can you tell me? Purity of rho, of course we know that is less or equal than 1, but what is the lower bound? That's right. Okay. And 1 over d, of course, means that you know nothing about your state. This is kind of cool, right? Because I tell you, you can always find a decomposition like that. What does it mean to know nothing? What it means to know nothing is that, so if the purity, well, let's do it this way. What is the purity of a state that is 1 over d identity? What does that mean? That state means that pick your favorite, let's think first in a basis. Pick your favorite basis and it's a homogeneous distribution over all the elements of the basis. Make sense? So that means that you could be in any of those states with equal probability of the basis. But it's also the identity, which is happens to be a multiple, so a multiple of the identity, happens to be the only family of operators that is invariant under change of basis. Which means that in any basis, pick your favorite basis, and it's always going to be a homogeneous distribution. You have no clue of what that state is. You cannot be clever here and say, oh, yeah, no, but I can find a basis. No, no, you have no freaking clue. This one is the same in all bases. Okay? So the purity of that, right, is the trace of 1 over d identity square, right? And we have that this is 1 over d square, the trace of the identity, which is, of course, 1 over d. Agreed? So this is the minimum purity. We call the identity, we call rho 1 over d identity the maximally mixed state. You can tell already that if we were working in infinite dimensions, it would have to be very careful. No? Agreed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Well, you have to be very careful. That's the point. Quantum information, typically, at least in course in quantum information, people don't do continuous variables, don't do infinite dimensions. So it's all fine for finite dimensions. I may make comments about infinite dimensions, but casually. Make sense, everybody? So the maximally mixed state in infinite dimensions, as here, is not well defined. No. I'm telling you. Has to be with the fact whether, we'll discuss about it. All right, very nice. So now what we realize, and I want to do here, I hope I have time for it. What we realize here is that, so you're telling me now that you get in your quantum state and you can have ignorance about your quantum state, right? But there is a very natural way of quantifying ignorance. We saw it in the first lecture, which is the Shannon entropy. We can talk about the Shannon entropy of a given rho, right? And if we talk about the Shannon entropy of a given rho, okay? So the Shannon entropy of a state rho, let me write it here, h of rho, to call it that first. That h of rho, what's it going to be? Well, it's a probability distribution. We found the expression. Now, is this probability distribution of being the random variable here is the state that you have. We know exactly the expression because we found it in the first lecture. So this is going to be minus sum pi log pi. Agreed? Everybody, that's the Shannon entropy of the state. Now, of course, this thing, it's equal to the expectation value is the trace of rho log rho. Minus, of course. Agreed?
Pi I is always in a fractional basis.
Say again?
Pi I is always a diagonal basis.
Phi I is?
Always diagonal basis.
Yeah, yes. In principle, you can have degeneracy, but you can always find a diagonal. When you have degeneracy, you have a little indefinition of what state you're in. But it's because you have degeneracy in probability of being in one on the other. So you have a little bit, you can find an orthonormal basis always. Yeah.
About what I mean is like we can always.
If they are not if they were not orthonormal, this would not have trace one. So in order for it to have trace one, this has to be orthonormal. Because the PI is sum to one. Make sense? So certainly, what I write like that is orthonormal. Make sense, everybody? Okay. So again, this is important. It's a classical probability distribution over distinguishable states. And again, it's orthonormal. That's implied by the fact that the trace has to be one. Where is the trace? The trace has to be one. And it's only true with a p summing to one if these are orthonormal. Otherwise, you have sum of pi plus pj, at some point in the cross product of those.
But if you take a trace, there's no cross trace.
What's that?
There's no cross trace.
Yeah, sorry, my bad. No, there is an issue if it's not orthonormal. Let's see. If it's not orthonormal, no, it's still fine. It's still fine as the definition of the state. It's still fine as definition of the state. But then again, this is guaranteed to be orthonormal, at least for different eigenvalues. For different PIs, it's orthonormal. Because it's self-adjoint. That makes sense? I mean, there's a theorem. I can prove. I don't know if you know that theorem, right? The eigenvectors corresponding to different eigenvalues of a self-adjoint operator are orthonormal. Do you agree with that?
If we interpret density matrix as a classical mixture of any pure state,
that's correct.
Then we can choose any.
You can, but I'm saying that there's at least one representation where this is.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Yeah. And in that, so the way if the different ways in which you can represent it is not unique, and that's what you will practice in the tutorial. You can do it in many ways, but there's one in which these are orthonormal.
Yes.
Make sense?
Yes.
All right. All right. Good. So that's the Shannon entropy of the state. Agreed? And I can write it like that. And then if I am a little bit cheeky about it, I can say, oh, I can make it something that looks like a thermodynamic entropy by multiplying by KVT, no? So then I'd say, and I define S of rho. Did I call it S? Yeah, I call it S. Divided by KVT. Agreed? So I define something that I call von Neumann entropy. That is, by definition, minus KVT trace of rho log rho. Make sense? And I call that the von Neumann entropy of the state. Now, what's the von Neumann entropy of the state? The von Neumann entropy of the state is simply the Shannon entropy of the state multiplied by KVT. Question?
What do you define to be the temperature of like a system of qubits or something?
Yeah, you see? So the von Neumann entropy typically, maybe I should say, this is my mistake. This will be a thermodynamic entropy. Let me define the von Neumann entropy without that. My bad. So the von Neumann entropy is the Shannon entropy of the state rho. And it reminds you of something that could be thermodynamic entropy if you adjust the units by dimensional analysis with KVT. Make sense? Yeah, sorry about that. I was jumping ahead. Yeah, von Neumann entropy doesn't have KVT, obviously. I was thinking of thermodynamic entropy. Make sense, everybody? Okay. So the next question, of course, by the way, what is the maximum and the minimum of that? What are the bounds of this? So who can tell me?
From 0 to infinity.
That's right. So you can tell that the von Neumann entropy in infinite dimensions is unbounded. Make sense, everybody? You get 0 when you have the probability PI being 1 for one I and 0 for the rest, and you get log D for the homogeneous distribution, which is 1 over D. The probabilities, all of them are 1 over D. Make sense? Okay. Now, oops. Now, this is an entropy or something that looks like an entropy, a Shannon entropy. The question was asked in the last lecture whether this is a thermodynamic entropy or not. Is the Shannon entropy, is the informational entropy of the state, which remember is the ignorance you have in the state, right? It's 0 when you know when the state is pure, exactly, and it's maximal when it's have no clue. It's the multiple of the identity, the maximally mixed state. So is the Shannon entropy of a state, which is what we call the von Neumann entropy of a quantum state, is it thermodynamical? Is it a thermodynamic entropy or not? That's the question that we want to answer. Make sense? What do you think? Is it or not? If you say, you said yes?
Yeah.
But what are your reasons? Why do you think it's thermodynamic? I can't hear, sorry. That's not a bad argument, but I would need to explain what you mean by interpret as, right? Because that's assuming that you know some things about thermodynamics, about what it means maximizing entropy and what's the distribution, and that's what we're gonna do. So the answer is right, but we need to flesh out the details. Let's talk about the notion of Gibbs thermality. What is Gibbs thermality? Okay, let's discuss it. Gibbs was trying to characterize what we mean by thermal states are a mystery, aren't they? They're complicated. Why? Because thermal states are, you say that they are states of equilibrium under given constraints, right? And those states of equilibrium, it's weird because if you have something very large and it has a state of equilibrium like that and you put anything small in contact with it, it will eventually become a thermal state of some kind. And that's kind of weird. It shows the power of thermodynamics in a way, because it's really weird. It's very universal, and the mechanisms that govern it, I don't care about the microscopics and microscopic. It could be weird. I don't care much about the microscopics. It seems to happen a lot. You see thermalization a lot. So what Gibbs said is, okay, let me try to characterize what it means for the description of the macroscopics to be in a state of equilibrium, right? And the notion of Gibbs thermality is the following. We have a second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics, different many formulations of it. The one that I'm gonna get is that under spontaneous processes, entropy can only increase or stay the same. Make sense? So Gibbs thinks of equilibration, the problem of equilibration, as follows. Like, well, equilibration is a succession of spontaneous processes. I have a system that's not in equilibrium with this environment, then I release my hands from it. It will start undergoing processes, and at some point it will stop. When it stopped, it's reached equilibrium. Make sense? So Gibbs says, all right, so if I'm taking steps towards equilibrium, when I'm evolving, when I'm equilibrating, what I'm doing is evolving spontaneously, because I'm taking steps towards equilibrium when left alone. Then those are spontaneous processes. Therefore, at every step, entropy has to increase. So that means that when I finally reach equilibrium, I should have achieved some sort of maximum of that entropy because the system is not evolving anymore. I've achieved the maximum possible entropy here. Make sense? Spontaneous processes leave it the same. That's the reasoning behind the notion of Gibbs thermality. Make sense? Now, of course, what constraints you impose define different kinds of states, right? If you say, that's what different families of ensembles that you've studied in your statistical mechanics. But in particular, let's take a look at what we call the canonical ensemble. Okay. So this is maximize entropy under the constraint that energy is constant. So what we say is that, okay, we let the system equilibrate, but we don't allow the system to exchange matter, if you want, with the environment. And we are assuming that the amount of energy in the system is constant. So it's a self-equilibration, in a way. Make sense? So the system will spontaneously evolve. This is example, typical example. You have the room, and you put all the air molecules on one side, and then you release the wall. There's no energy coming into the system, thing is isolated, but then the system will evolve through spontaneous processes until there's a homogeneous distribution of molecules, and that's the state of maximal entropy. We're talking classical thermodynamics here. Make sense? So we already know that if we do this in classical thermodynamics, as we've done, we end up with the state of the system being something like a Boltzmann distribution, that, depending on what you have, but in classically a Boltzmann distribution. Agreed? The populations of the different energy levels have these Maxwell-Boltzmann factors. Agreed? That's that what you've done in statistical mechanics, maybe the first 10 lectures or so. No? All right. Now, what we're going to do then is, instead of trying to maximize the classical entropy of something, we're going to try to maximize the von Neumann entropy, so the Shannon entropy of the state. Now, if the Shannon entropy is actually of the state is actually the thermodynamic entropy, it should give you the same Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution or something similar. If it's not, well, it might by chance, you see, so this is not a proof that it's thermodynamic, but it might be a very compelling argument that the Shannon entropy of the state is a thermodynamic entropy. Make sense? At least in this situation. Make sense, everybody? You always.
It's nothing to do with the Shannon entropy. You said when the molecules are in the half of the room and then you remove the barrier, so you basically did no work.
Correct.
For energy, and then they evolve. But where does the energy of moving the barrier go?
It doesn't matter. The barrier could be almost zero mass. So if I factors no weight, because I can do it with a very heavy one, there's a lot of work that I have to do on the barrier to move it, or I can do it with a very light one, so obviously it cannot depend because the state is the same.
Okay.
Make sense? No, it's good. Those are the questions that one asks in thermodynamics. It's good. No, no, it's not trivial. Sometimes something that looks innocent is actually not innocent. Ask Maxwell about it, and Siller and others. All right. Are we on the same page, more or less, on the notion of what I mean by Gibbs thermality and how to compute? So that maximizing a thermodynamic entropy should give me the state of equilibrium. That's the notion of Gibbs thermality. Now what we're going to do is maximize the Shannon entropy of the state, AKA the von Neumann entropy, and see what kind of state we get. Again, we're going to flesh out what you said. All right? It's 10, going slow this year. OK, let me just set up the problem, and we leave it there, and we solve it next day. How about that? Now, we have a little bit of a problem, because we're in a quantum system. So and what does it mean to have constant energy, right? OK, so what we're going to do is maximize S being the von Neumann entropy under the constraints that the expectation of the Hamiltonian on rho is constant. So yeah, we're demanding that on average, because again, energy may not be well defined in that state. It actually is well defined, but as a classical distribution, we know that. And I'll tell you why in a second. And of course, the trace of rho has to be one. That's a mathematical constraint that we need to impose for the, because otherwise, if you ask the mathematical problem, maximize the function s, which is trace rho log rho, then it's going to tell you, oh yeah, take the one where the log diverges, and yeah, it's not going to be a good thing unless we keep it in the set of physical states. Make sense? Now, the first thing that we want is to realize that we're looking at states of equilibrium. So in states of equilibrium, the result of that maximization has to be such that, agreed? That's a necessary condition for equilibration. Because if you don't commute with the Hamiltonian, you're going to evolve. Make sense? So this is going to be important for our derivation. We're going to use it as well. That the thing is that, OK, I want to find the rho of equilibrium. I know for a fact that the rho of equilibrium is like that. So I'm not going to be stupid and do more math, because I know already it has to be like that, that state of equilibrium. So I can assume that that's the case for the result. Make sense? All right. And I'm going to write the equation that we want to solve. So this is a problem of optimization, all right? And in particular, a problem of Lagrange multipliers, optimization under constraints. Make sense? So I'm going to write the equation. Let me write the symbol first, and then we interpret that symbol. S minus beta trace rho hat h hat minus e minus mu trace of rho hat minus 1 equals zero. So what does that mean? I mean, well, take the variation over all possible density operators of this, of the entropy that I want to extremalize with the following constraints. That the trace is equal to E, the trace of rho H is equal to E, and the trace of rho is equal to 1. And beta and mu are Lagrange multipliers. Make sense? So this is the problem that we have to solve. Any questions? We will solve this problem in the next lecture. Does that make sense to everyone? It's amazing. When you have two lectures that are one after the other, delivery is faster. That is, it's 1 hour. I guess you have to wait for everybody to arrive. Yeah, there's some inefficiency of having. This year is different from the past one, so I'm slightly behind, maybe like 5 minutes to 10 minutes behind. Yeah. I'll make up for it. Anyway, any questions about any of this? Is that clear? I think it's pretty clear, right? I don't know if I... Yeah. Anyway, I think that the notion of density operators is well understood, no? Again, you've seen it 1,000 times. I think that the notion of density operators as a classical probability distribution over well-known states is understood. The fact that this, the decomposition as a probability distribution over states is not unique is a thing, and you will see it in the tutorial in more detail. But you can always diagonalize rho and find an expression like this. All right, make sense? For which, for different probabilities, these are going to be orthogonal.
What do you mean by taking the derivative with respect to rho?
Ah, good. That we need to specify. That means I did say it, but I said it very fast. Okay. That means vary all possible states, right? And make this quantity equal to zero, which is optimization of this quantity over all possible states under these constraints. We're going to have to work to operate with this, right? You cannot just take a partial derivative. This doesn't mean partial derivative with respect to the symbol rho hat. That means variation with rho. We're going to find out what it is.
If you didn't have these two conditions, would that give you the maximally mixed state?
No.
1 over d? Log d?
No.
Because
what two conditions, sorry?
The two Lagrange multipliers.
The solution to this, you mean?
Yeah.
It's not the maximally mixed state. We'll see.
This isn't, but I'm just saying if you didn't have the conditions, that the energy is...
Oh, yeah. It will give you the maximally mixed state and the pure state with you all the streamum.
Yeah. Yeah. You said at some point, I just want to...
No, this one you have to, right? It's a physical state. You need to impose that. If not, the problem is ill-defined. You're going to get the rho equals zero.
If you don't have energy conservation, then you will get maximally mixed state.
If you don't have energy conservation, you're going to get the pure states, the maximally mixed state, all the extremum here.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yep. Right. Make sense, everybody? Any questions?
Yeah, if you start with a pure state and...
What do you mean start?
You have some ensemble that you know the state of. You can write the density matrix of some set of qubits. And you just unitarily evolve this.
Yeah.
This won't change the entropy.
No.
So, the von Neumann entropy is...
This is really good, because in the sample of the gas, this is a really good example. Because the von Neumann entropy will not always be the thermodynamic entropy.
Right.
But that happens in classic, that's not quantum. That also happens in classical mechanics. There's something called observational entropy. And there's the notion of observational entropy versus thermodynamic entropy, or the let me call it the Gibbs, or the Boltzmann entropy. You have the Boltzmann entropy, and then you say, the Boltzmann entropy is the thermodynamic entropy. What I'm going to prove here is more about the von Neumann entropy being the Boltzmann entropy. But this is really good, because the entropies of mixtures and the free expansions are tricky. Because the entropy increases, but the evolution is symplectic classically and unitary in the quantum case, that cannot increase the entropy. Yeah.
So
that's because of observational entropy. Yeah.
Okay. So, really, if we have perturbed any closed system, we couldn't change the entropy of it.
Agreed, 100%. What happens though is that you have to factor in what measurements you can do. Yeah.
So, really, the entropy is a measurement of subsystems in it, right?
Totally. The entropy is a measurement in a way of your state of knowledge.
Yeah.
And thermodynamic entropy. So what I'm going to prove here is weaker than the truth. And the truth is that thermodynamic entropy has to factor in your ability to obtain knowledge from the system. Your ability to extract work from a system depends on what you can actually do with the system. And that's why there's a notion called, we're talking now close to state of the art of thermodynamics. Huh? Observational entropy. Observational entropy is the quantity that takes into account your ability to do stuff with it.
That's non-unitary, so it would also change the entropy of the system.
Well, depending on the measurements. Because you're thinking of projective measurements?
Yes.
Not necessarily. Most realistic measurements tend to be non-projective. We'll see measurements here as well, POVMs in general. Not all measurements are projective. In fact, most of them are not. Projective measurements are unphysical. They're an approximation to something that, for some systems, happens okay. Yeah, yeah.
Is this something that is like a widely held notion, or is this something that is something that's more foundational?
It's very foundational, but it's also, let me give you the example of the gas. I actually picked that example, and I'm glad that it provoked. Maybe that was it. So if you have a gas, imagine that you have a gas like that. Think this is also in classical, but let's think quantum because it's easier. You're more familiar with the notions of time evolution in quantum mechanics, funny enough, than in classical mechanics. You have a gas and a wall, right? And that gas is in a quantum state. Say that, whatever, is a state with entropy S, right? And then you release the wall. And of course, we know that the thermodynamical entropy of that increases, right? Because now it has to occupy the rest of the room. The number of microconfigurations compatible with microconfiguration given. So the opposite. Number of microconfigurations compatible with the macroconfiguration we see has increased a lot. However, you've done that. Also, you've done entropy. That's called a free expansion. It's the first thing you do in thermodynamics, one of the first things. Entropy of mixtures. You have one gas here. I release the wall, and they mix. And now the entropy has increased. Agreed? Now, the evolution of that is fully unitary. If I isolate the system, I don't let energy out, and I don't let matter out or in, that's unitary evolution, right? Unitary evolution cannot change the von Neumann entropy. So the von Neumann entropy cannot really account totally for the thermodynamic entropy. Yes?
Could you think of like the entropy of a thermal state as like the size of the phase space? Because what you're doing when you open the box, the
there is going to be a term, not always, but there's going to be a term that goes with the volume of phase space, indeed. Huh. Yeah, totally.
So then when we're measuring subsystems, like if we know...
You are reducing the volume of phase space, yes.
And it might take different shapes based on the knowledge of the others.
Totally, 100%.
It's wild.
I know, right? But that is thermodynamics. Yeah. The thermodynamical entropy has, for many years, for decades, not to say even centuries, we have tried to characterize the entropy of a system only looking at the system. It's not enough. The thermodynamic entropy, the one that tells you whether you can extract work, you can are going to have heat flows, the real thermodynamic entropy that you need for your engines, is not only a function of the system. It's a function of what you can do with the system, you can observe in the system. That is very important. And that's the notion of observational entropy. Again, we're talking almost state of the art. People, in the classical sense, has been known for some time. Not a lot, but for some time. In the quantum thermodynamics case, it's new. This is new stuff. It's happening as we speak. By new, I mean the last 3, 4 years, 5 years, yeah. Makes sense? Yeah. No, this is wild. I'm glad we're discussing it. In a way, it's quantum info. It's less, okay, in a course of quantum info, the focus may not be this, but it's certainly related with information because we're talking about this makes it even more physical, that informational entropies are actually thermodynamic entropies. So it's not bad. So what we're going to do is going to try to match the Boltzmann entropy under the assumption that the Boltzmann entropy is a thermodynamic entropy because that's what you've been studying all the time. However, it's even more than that. You need to factor in not only knowledge about the state, you need to factor in knowledge about what you can do with the state, the measurements that you can make. And that gives you the thermodynamic entropy, the real thermodynamic entropy. Yeah, it is wild. I agree. It's cool, though. That makes sense to everybody? It's tough. And the reason it's tough is because one has to accept that most of the thermodynamics you've seen are like grossly incomplete. But you already knew that, no? I mean, in a way, as you were saying, the problem of a mixture is unitary evolution. How come the entropy increases under unitary evolution? Clearly, it's not just the state's entropy that's telling you that.
So
Wait, how does the phase space increase when?
Not the phase space, but what you cover, the state, the area covered by the distribution of the state.
Let's say you had a piston and then you pushed all the gas from the both sides, just one side. Now the entropy.
You are decreasing the effect.
Yeah. That system is decreased, but the entropy of the universe as a whole is the.
Sure.
Why does it increase? I mean, if it's just an increase of the phase space volume, what volume has increased so that the entropy.
So hold on, no. What I mean is that the entropy of a thermal state will have a factor that goes with the volume of the phase space. Because a thermal state kind of occupies a lot of the phase space. Okay, it's in a way expanding over phase space. You know, that's why for equilibration, you actually need several notions of your system. You need the system to be ergodic.
So when you do that, you wouldn't say that the entropy is just, okay, so that's one of the terms.
That's right.
I thought it was like,
but what you're talking about is not an equilibrium thing. It's a non-equilibrium thing. So we're talking about thermality. In the case of thermality, in order to thermalize something, it needs to be able to get to know the whole of phase space, the whole of it.
Right.
Which means that the evolution, the time evolution, that it's giving you that equilibration has to be ergodic. Ergodic means that it gets arbitrarily close to every point of phase space if you wait enough. So if it's an evolution that is restricted to orbits in phase space, that's not going to equilibrate. For example, integrable systems. Integrable systems will not equilibrate, typically.
Right.
Will not thermalize. So the only things that thermalize are non-integrable systems. And we see that everything in life freaking thermalizes. So maybe things are really non-integrable, even though we only solve integrable systems all the time. See what I mean? We have theorems that tells you that you cannot thermalize if you are integrable. Which makes sense, because again, how are you going to end up in a state that is something that contains the volume of the whole phase space if you're not allowed to visit everywhere in phase space? Before settling for equilibrium, you have to live your life, which means you have to travel phase space, all of it. If you don't know about phase space, how the heck are you going to thermalize and equilibrate? You need to know your phase space. And this is cool. And this is, thermodynamics is probably one of the most beautiful branches of physics, and it's sad that has been neglected for so long, right? We did a lot of classical thermodynamics, then statistical mechanics booms, and after that, it's kind of a low, and then things become trendy. Now it's trendy again, which is good. The field of quantum thermodynamics is trendy now. About time.
It's just an approximation, because wouldn't it take like an infinite amount of time for things to.
It depends on your system. It depends on characteristics on your system. There's a thermalization time. In a way, you assume that things equilibrate, and then again, we talk observationally. At some point, you're not going to see any evolution. And that typically happens at a finite time. It doesn't mean that in theory, you're not still doing something microscopic. I don't care, but I don't see more change. So you have to factor in what you can observe there.
Okay.
Yeah. The thermalization time, so for example, you're in finite dimensions, you have a recursion time as well. So if you evolve, well, for finite dimensions, I can tell you a time in which you would get the closest to being thermal. And that's a time. That's a well-defined time. For infinite dimensional ones, it depends a lot on the system. But in principle, if you give me a threshold of when I'm not going to see change anymore, I can give you a time. Make sense? Okay. I think that's it. I don't know if I have to erase. Probably not, because they...